do verse.
Apuryamanam achala pratishtam
samudramapah pravishanti yatvate
tatvat kamayam pravishanti sarve
sa shantim apnoti na kama kami
apuryamanam achala pratishtam samudram apah pravishanti yatvat tadvat kamaha yam pravishanti sarve saha shantim apnoti nakama kami. After Bhagavan telling Arjuna that what is day for a jnani is night for a jnani and vice versa, as Swamiji said in his commentary, that could have been a little discouraging for him. Because now how can I know? You know, how can I know? Because I don't know. You know? So even if there's any description there, how can I really know until I know? So they thought, Krishna thought, well, let me give him a little different kind of an example that's descriptive of a jnani. So it's beautiful. So he says, apuryamanam achalam achala pratishtam samudram. Samudra means the ocean. The ocean which just by its nature is apuryamanam. It's full. It's full to what we call full to the brink. You know, you can't fill it anymore. Just, you know, are you going to throw some cups of water in and just say, how can you fill it more? It is full. The ocean is full as it is. And not only that, it's immobile. The ocean can't just stand up and move over. Right. And it's very well grounded. So achala means it's immobile. It can't walk away. It's steady, it's firm, it's there. And it's pratishta. Pratishta means it has its place. So it can't walk away, and it's very well grounded. So he says, just like the apaha, water, always in plural, in the water is what it just means, water, pravishanti, yadvat, just as the waters enter the ocean, which is already full to the brink, very grounded and immovable, you know. Tadvat, like that, kamaha, desires, sarve kamaha, all desires, pravishanti, enter into whom all the desires enter, right, that person, shantim apnoti, gain shanti. Nakami, not the kami, not the one who has the raga dvesha. Kami means kama, it's a little Sanskrit lesson. Kama means desire. Kamin, that in affix and in the nominative singular, will be kami, the one who has desires. So often you'll see that in affix, it means the one who has that. So the one who still has raga dvesha, for that person, there really is no shanti. The shanti is for the one who is like the ocean. One who, being like the ocean, all of the desires, all of the raga dvesha as non-binding desires enter into whom that one remains full and complete without really changing at all. Without changing at all. That's what we mean by non-binding raga dveshas. You can do all kinds of, go after all kinds of things in the world, whatever is coming out of your prarabdha karma, actually, the karmas that made you, brought you here in the first place, you know, to take this birth in the first place. All of the activities, all of the karmas that you do, all of the raga dveshas, non-binding raga dveshas, likes and dislikes that are there, you know, all of those are free to pour in. They're free to pour in without myself becoming more or less full. The shanti, the nature of myself, can remain and does remain exactly as it is. The whole universe comes into manifestation and comes into unmanifest condition. The shanti of myself is of a different, it's of a different order of reality. That's actually what it is. Your being, the conscious being that you are, cannot be objectified to become an object in the creation. Or you can't become someone who is subject to time and space. Time and space exists in you. You know, you don't exist in time and space. That's the understanding of satyam mitya. This whole creation exists in me. I don't exist in the creation. I exist in the creation only in the sense that I am the being, the Sat-Chit Ananda. I am the very being that the creation enjoys. Like just in this room, just to see, in this room, as you're experiencing this room through your sense organs, you're displaying, you're experiencing a display of nama-rupa, of names and forms, of all different colors, of all different sorts. Is everything different from everything else? It's just a collage. It's a collage of names and forms. But sorry, 1 second. I just lost my track there. But there's one thing in our experience here is just infinite diversity. Literally infinite. Because anything that you think is a nama rupa, as a name and form, can actually be divided, you know, torn apart into smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, infinitely. So even to say that these things are forms is really a misnomer. It's not really true. Everything that you experience is just a name. It's a name of name within names within names within names. That's what we have here. But everything is different, right? I can differentiate this from this from this. But we have another experience in terms of what we're of our experience here. And that is that everything equally exists. This is. You can't say, this over here is a little more isness than this over here. All right. This has a little bit more being than this has. No. The being is absolutely the same. And you can't divide it up. It's not like, okay, being blank, being blank, being blank. As though there's little spaces in between being. There are no spaces. There's not spaces between one object's being and another object's being and another object's being. In fact, there's this nama-rupa space, nama-rupa space, nama-rupa space, but all have being equally. And then also, if I'm looking this way, being, look this way, being. There is no escape from being. So Swamiji used to always go, when he's doing this prakriya, actually, this is a teaching methodology that we use. If you look around the room, you go like this, you look over to the wall, maybe 15 feet from here, the wall is, the space is, the body is, you know, the body is, sense organs are. So as I'm doing this, you say, yes, that's true. The wall is, the space is, the body is, the sense organs are, the mind is, the thoughts are, the I thought is, my knowledges are, my ignorance is, my relationships are, you know, and I are. I is. I am. There's no gap anywhere. Just like if you think in the dream. If you have a dream, the whole manifestation of the dream is just a kaleidoscope of nama-rupa with sattva, rajas, tamas. Sattva is it all exists in conscious being, or as it all is. And in it, all of this activity is taking place. That's the rajas, there's nama-rupa, the whole thing. The whole thing of absolutely infinite nama-rupa, name and form, that is making up that dream. But I know that the whole dream equally is, and I know that the isness which the dream enjoys is my amness. Now we're even looking, when you look at the dream, especially the dream from the waking state, what you recognize that even in these different orders of reality, like the waking state and the dream state, both orders of reality are really enjoying being. Right? So the dream state enjoys being, the waking state enjoys being. That's clear. It is, it is, it is, it is. And I also am. Everything about my experience, including me, am, is. You know. But, you know, when I do that same prakriya, that look at the dream state in that way also, I get a little bit different insight. I see that every single thing in the dream, including the person I'm identified in the dream, is, and the isness is invariable. I also see that the isness that it enjoys is me, which is not in the dream. In other words, the being that the dream enjoys is, from its standpoint, completely free from the dream. That is your experience. It's a very important experience in terms of trying to really understand Vedanta, because the dream state is, when the dream state is gone, I still am. Right? And you even have the experience when the dream state, when you wake up from that dream state, that what actually is has not changed at all. Your own being is still there completely. You don't feel, it is not one's experience, that the dream, in the absence of the dream, I have lost something. The dream experience is gone, but I don't feel that something has been ripped away from me, or that I've lost something that is actually tangible. And the reason I don't feel that is because we classify very easily and with shraddha and knowledge that this dream state is mithya. Mithya means the dream state has no independent reality. If I tell you the dream comes from me, is sustained by me, it resolves into me, well, that makes sense. It's my dream. Right? You can do what you want with it, but it makes sense. It comes from me, sustained by me, resolves into me. When I wake up from it, nothing really happens. I'm still there. I have had no death experience. It's interesting, it's just very unusual, but some people, and I think I've had it once that I recall, where you die in the dream. Like say that in the dream, you jump off a cliff or something, and then you go crashing to the bottom and probably wakes you up. But what is so amazing that in spite of the death in the dream, there is no death experience. There is a death in the dream. Some of you jumped off the cliff and you fell to the ground. But there is no death experience at all. And that is because there is no death experience at all. Never, ever. There cannot be one. Because what actually is, the conscious being that actually is, me, is not in that order of reality. So what is the very truth of the dream, right? Doesn't depend on the dream to be. But the dream totally depends upon me. It's not an equal relationship. Satyam, that which actually is, and mithya are two orders of reality. This is so clear to me when I analyze the dream. And when I wake up, you notice that, and always it's kind of just interesting, you know. You wake up and nothing has happened to you. Even if the dream is very, very real and you miss it, oh, I wanted to see the end of that. It takes the status of a really good movie, you know, and it was cut short. And the movie was cut short. But it's not that I was cut short, or something happened in reality where my life, all of a sudden, I was in this wonderful, extraordinary life, and all of a sudden it just came to an end like that. No, I lost my movie. You know, it's like the film strip broke. But there was no change for me. And so the dream is such a powerful example to be able to bring my mind to the reality of that satya-mitya relationship. Because you can even as an ajnani, even if you're not clear about the nature of yourself, when you're using that dream example, you can say, yeah, that dream is mitya. That dream depends on me for its being, but I don't depend upon it. Otherwise, when I wake up, when the dream goes away, I would have lost something. And nor is there any such experience, because one order of reality does not affect the other order of reality. So I am stable. In reference to the dream, I am stable. Nothing can happen in the dream that changes or alters my being. Not possible. So here, that's even in reference to existence. But the existence or my being is not just being. It is not just existence. It is consciousness. Existence and consciousness are one and the same thing. There are two words pointing to one being. Being itself is consciousness. So just as I can say, whether it be in reference to the dream, I'll do that in a minute, but in reference to this creation right now, not only everything is, without exception, every thought is, every object is, every experience is, not part of it, the whole experience. Nothing can escape it. It's an invariable, that's the invariable, being, isness, amness. But not only that, every experience, like this perception in this room right now, is known. It's not like part of this room is known, but there's a little hole right there. Everything that is being experienced as this right now has one thing in common. It is known. It is known. Means as long as it is here, I can say it is self-evident in that it is known. It's self-evident. That's not quite true to say, because the self-evidentness comes from the is-knownness itself. Because if you think so, what it actually boils down to is the is-knownness that it enjoys is the self-evident consciousness of being. So if everything enjoys being, it also enjoys is-knownness. But because you can't separate being from knownness. So let's give an example of that again. So I can say this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known. This body is known, is the sat, known, chit. This body is known. My sense organs are known. Just see this as I'm doing it. My sense organs are known. My thoughts are known. I try to have a thought that's not known. It's not possible. My emotions are known. The ahankara is known. The I notion is known. Space is known. You know? My knowledge is known, my ignorance is known, I know that I know what I don't know. You know. If you ask me, do you know Chinese? No, I don't know Chinese. So how do you know you don't know? I don't know, believe me, I know I don't know. All of these things they are known, and I also am known. There is no gap. The is-knownness goes to the very nature of conscious being. That is known, this is known, this is known, this is known. This is just a word. Is known is a word, right? But that word is known is actually labeling the self-evident experience of me. Me is a conscious, it is a label for consciousness itself. So what I mean is, if say, Everything exists, if we say like this, everything exists within consciousness. There is no experience that is apart from consciousness. How do you know that? Because there is no experience that is not known. That knownness is consciousness. So now say when we're doing contemplation, we're doing a meditation, just think about what you're left with when you meditate. Like today when we did some knitted dhyasana, you know, and we gently, you know, turned the mind, just we got so relaxed so that the mind was not really having to focus, did all our inner work, you know, and then we did some pranayama, you know, and then we turned our attention toward my own, or chanted, and then we turned the attention toward my own being, you know, toward me. And then is that me that we're turning our attention to and not just sitting, being myself? Is that an inert experience? Is it inert? When I'm just sitting with myself and welcoming all of the thoughts, I'm welcoming all of the vrittis, all of the thoughts, when I'm doing this, all of the thoughts, and just allowing them to be with me, I'm not pushing them away, am I bringing them into inertness? Please come with me so that, come into the inertness that I am. Come into the non-existence that I am. No. I'm resolving all experience, just consciously aware that I'm resolving every single experience that I have, every emotion that I have, into conscious being. I'm resolving them all into the is-knownness, the self-evident me, which supports them when they are up. When the experience is up, it is known. When the experience is resolved, what is left is the is-known, the self-evident experience. Self-evident means no pramana, no means of knowledge is coming around to light me up. That everything else, every other experience I have, it depends on the mind being up, or it depends upon my sense organs, you know, being available to give me this experience of these nama rupas. But I don't need my mind or my sense organs to give me a self experience. I am the conscious being because of whom all of these things are known. So if I am the one because of whom all of these experiences are and are known, what happens if I get rid of all of these experiences? In all of the perceptions, you know, if I get rid of all of the perceptions, if I get rid of all of the vrittis, all of the thought modifications, which are known when they're there and when they're not known, when they're not there, then what? Then what? I get rid of all of them. If I turn my mind toward myself, you know, pulling away from any type of nama rupa, then what? The same me. The same is known is there. The is known is that is known when I'm recognizing that it is not have anything to do with an object. It is what we call self-evident. So I am self-evident. I can never erase myself. I can erase everything else. That's why having an experience sometimes of non-existence is a really interesting. That's a good meditation. That's what sent Ramana, you know, off to the mountains. His he was trying to non-exist. Let me just die. Let me imagine. Let me imagine what it's like to be dead. Okay. That's trying to imagine non-existence. Just get rid of me completely. Just I die. Okay, so you imagine, another way to say that is you just imagine non-existence. There is nothing. There is nothing. So to the degree that you can do that, you just try to withdraw your mind from any type of vritti, any type of nama-rupa, you just wipe the whole thing out, there is nothing. Then what are you left with? Nothing? No. You're left with me, the one who is illumining nothing. That's the truth of it. You're left with me, the Sat-Chit, conscious being, self-evident me, now illumining a vritti of nothing. Okay? So illumining a concept of non-existence. And say, oh, I'm only illuminating a concept of non-existence. I'm not doing it well enough. Okay. Let's try to get rid of the concept itself, you know. But I'll tell you what, let's get rid of the non-existence itself, because even non-existence is there somehow. Non-existence isn't there. Non-existence is not there. You are there. And you don't have any hands and legs and mind or, you know, weapons or anything that exists within duality to do anything about it. Right? How are you going to get rid of the one because of whom everything else is known? What can you do? Nothing. What space do you take up? You're not an object in space. Space belongs to the creation, just like space belongs to your dreams. Space belongs to your imagination. Time doesn't belong to you. Time belongs to the world of change. Just imagine, everything stops. Absolutely everything stops. Where is change? Change has stopped. Time has stopped. There can't be time without change. You need movement for change, for time. Change and time go together. Time belongs to the creation. Space belongs to the creation. Space, air, fire, water, earth, sattva, rajas, and tamas. The sattva is that which allows this creation to be reflected as though, to be known in terms of the known relationships that go on within the creation. That's what we call sattva. Rajas is all of the energy that allows the whole creation is continually in motion. Tamas is the nama-rupa, all of the name and form. That's why for your convenience, actually, this paradigm of sattva, rajas, and tamas, how the creation comes into manifestation, goes out of manifestation, when it comes into manifestation, included in that manifestation, are all the jivas, who then are little knowers within that creation, just like your dream. They want you to see that everything about you, this body, mind, sense organs, all of your complexes, all of the little ones, they're also part of this dream. There's no exception. There's only one thing that's not part of this dream, and that is you, the one from whom this rather large, long-lasting dream comes. So you have the little subjective dream of the jiva, and you have Bhagavan's as though dream. It's an infinite manifestation of knowledge. That's what this is. And it all takes place in me. But just like I am the Ishwar of my dream, right? I am the Ishwar of my dream. From my standpoint, do you see that? Because when you dream, the subjective, but when you dream, the whole dream comes from you, right? It's sustained by you. It resolves into you. The entire dream takes place in your awareness. The entire dream is known, right? And within this dream, which is you, there are jivas, little individuals, all kinds of animals, they're all little jivas. And all the insects, they're little jivas, and the reptiles, they're jivas, the fish are jivas, the human beings are jivas. You know, all little jivas. Each one saying, I am, I am, I am, I'm the conscious being, I'm the conscious being, I'm the conscious being, I'm the conscious being, I know you, I know you. Yeah. But the truth of it all is that the satchit is the conscious being, which is me, is the conscious being, which every jiva enjoys fully because they have sattva, they have a sukshma sharira, they have a subtle body. And the chairs and all the chairs don't seem to talk, and the boards don't seem to talk, and the windows don't seem to talk, you know. So I'm conscious and you're not. But actually, everything in the dream is of the same order of reality. Some of the things in the dream are kind of mirror-like, reflecting me, and others are not. But the me doesn't belong to the ones that are reflecting any more than they belong to the board or to the window. It's more like this. This whole creation, or this whole creation comes from me. The me experience that of myself belongs to me. And then when the creation comes, everything in it is a manifestation that belongs to me.
parts of those that manifestation can talk. Some of them can bark. Some of them can meow. And some of them are just utilitarian, like the boards and the couch. But that doesn't make them any less me. It also doesn't mean this. This is important, and it's kind of a mind twister. It was for me when I realized it. The chair and the floor, you know, and the windows, etc., versus all of the individuals in the dream, neither one has the me experience. Neither one has the me experience. Why is that? You either have to say that every one of them has the me experience or none of them has the me experience. Because the me experience of being me, belongs to me. It belongs to me. And so everything has it because the whole thing is me. So think like this. Because I'm a jiva in the dream, I recognize that I am me, because I reflect consciousness as though I am me, you know, and you are you, and you are you, but the poor space is inert, right? But actually, when you say, I am me, and I am me, and I am me, and I am me, right? Are you thinking that your body, mind, sense organs is responsible for me, for you being me? You know, or is the self, conscious being, me? Where does this me experience come from? This is really critical, because otherwise, because I'll tell you what you're attached to, you're not attached to some limitless awareness. Who cares? Who cares? You know? Really? Seriously, who cares about it? Oh, great. I'm limitless awareness. No. Yeah. That's not the exciting thing. That's kind of the thing. It's not good enough at all. It's not at all good enough. But it is. It's when I realize that the me, myself, that is myself right now, the self that I believe, you know, is a product of this body, mind, sense organs conglomerate, this person here, because this me is here, this person is here, I am here. And so I believe that that which is really fundamentally me, the me that I'm so attached to, is the me that belongs to this body, mind, sense organs. And then there is a pratyek atma, an innermost self that illumines me. See what I mean? The pratyek atma, that innermost self, which is Brahman, you know, which cannot be objectified, that self, that atma, is illumining me. And so the me becomes an object of experience that belongs to this body, mind, sense organs conglomerate. And that is me. And that's the me that I'm attached to, that I don't want to die. But I guess I'm going to have to settle for Brahman, you know, for that innermost conscious being that illumines me. This is the shock. This is the aha moment in Vedanta, when you recognize that actually the conscious being that is this body, mind, sense organs, the very me that is this body, mind, sense organs, is the me which is Brahman. I am this body, mind, sense organs, and I, this me that is me that I love so much and don't want to die, it is this very me that is this body, mind, sense organs that is free of this body, mind, sense organs. There is no other me. There is no conscious being that is illumining me. The me that I am is the luminary, right? So think about it now. When you are contemplating, for instance, and you're objectifying everything, you objectify your body and you see that it can be subject-object identification, so subject-object differentiation. So I can do that. I can recognize through my sense organs. I can experience this body. I don't feel like I'm looking now at me, that I'm objectified. Now all of a sudden, I'm over there, right? I have now made a differentiation between the conscious being and this body, and so now me, yeah, I'm looking at it. I'm looking at this body. I'm looking at me. That is not my experience. The experience is I, this me, am objectifying this body. It's not like somebody else is back there that I didn't know about, and the me is now an object of my awareness. The body is an object of my awareness, not me. I am the one because of whom this body is known. I never think that the me is getting thrown into the pot, so to speak, of those things that are objectified and therefore dismissible. That's not the experience at all. I objectify my mind. I watch my thoughts come and go. I never have the experience as I'm watching my thoughts come and go that I'm watching me come and go. There goes me. Okay, here's this thought comes. This is me. The me is going, gone. Right? That's not the experience. I am the one. The me is the one who is, you know, illumining the thoughts. Because of me, the thoughts are known. You know, and even emotions. I have this emotion. I am this emotion. I'm objectifying the emotion. And then if I think the me is there, then I'm going to watch the me dissipate. As the emotion dissipates, I am dissipating. No, I, me, am freed from that emotion. So you never, ever, everything you objectify never touches me. I am, when we say the pratyagatma, the innermost self, we're not talking about some other self that is objectifying me. We're talking about the me who is always here. And so, in fact, that which is most dear to me, the one that I don't want to lose, the one who, well, if we have to go to heaven, if there's a heaven and whatnot, that's only okay if I'm going there. If there's somebody else going there, or some universal self, or someone other than me, then I honestly don't care. Why would you care? It's somebody you don't even know. Some light bulb in the back that is illuminating me. But no, I'm the light bulb. I am the one, you know? And so say as my mind discovers that, oh my gosh, that all of the Upanishads are talking to me about myself. And when they're talking about neutralizing all of these raga dveshas, why? Because the raga dveshas are just, they're nothing. The raga dveshas means my likes and dislikes, as though fulfilling this, getting this object, actually getting this object or this situation has anything to do with me. It has nothing to do with me. It doesn't add to me. It doesn't take away from me. All it does is give me a shamta vritti momentarily. It relaxes my mind momentarily. And that gives me some solace. I do all of these things. I suffer so much just to get what I want. I have so much stress and pressure trying to create a situation where I believe that I can be happy. I'm working like anything, you know, to try to manipulate the world so that I can have a shanta vritti. Shanta vritti means just a mind that enjoys some shanti, some peace. And then when I have that shanta vritti, you know why I feel so good? It's because nothing in the creation is competing with just my own being. My mind isn't turning into something that has a lot of stress or tension or darkness in it. And so I don't have to have those experiences for the moment. In the moment, I just get to be myself without any contrary experiences kind of ripping me apart, emotionally ripping me apart, really emotionally ripping me apart, because I take myself, my me, to be that. I take myself to be that, and now I'm being ripped apart by this emotional turmoil, which is a horrible thing. It's horrible. It's horrible for an ajnani. It's bad enough for a jnani, but if you have to have that. But it's horrible for an ajnani because you never know when it's going to change. How long is this horrible experience going to last? Is this it now? That's how we feel. The happy experiences you know so clearly, those are momentary. As soon as you have a happy experience, there's this, oh no. Because underneath, you know it's temporary, you know? But why is it so interesting when it's a really dark experience, like a depressed experience, a hurt experience or whatever, you're in that, is this ever going to lift? When am I going to get out of this? The problem, all this suffering, you know, all of this kind of dealing with all of these temporary states, is because I take me to be one with the experience. That's what it is. That's why actually the teaching methodologies of the Vedanta are very, very simple and at the same time difficult. They're very simple and they're difficult. They're difficult because that identification with the body, mind, sense organs is so much that no matter what the Upanishad is saying, whatever they mean in terms of self or awareness or existence, all of these words, they couldn't possibly be meaning me because I am this body. I am this person here. So everything they're saying is not really talking about the me that I'm most attached to. So the aha moment is that recognition. We need so many prakriyas, so many teaching methodologies, you know. Swamiji once says, you know, it's like the ahankara. The teacher is like has this huge, huge flashlight that is chasing this ahankara. You know, with all of the prakriyas, the Swamiji will go like this, you know. There we go, there we go, there we go, there we go, there we go. Okay. And the ahankara is going, you know, looking for places to hide, looking for little places. Because me, it's me. The ahankara doesn't want to die. You know, it doesn't want to face death. It's afraid it's going to face death, you know. But the ahankara is just a notion. The ahankara is a misidentification of me with this. That's why, and of course it's difficult. It's very difficult. It's difficult because of the satya-mitya relationship between me and this creation. How is the pot not going to identify with the clay? And it feels, it knows that it is fragile and can be broken. That means that me, the clay, is fragile and can be broken, right? Because it, from its standpoint, it is the clay. And is that true or not? He said, see, yeah, it is only the clay. Like that, this body is me. It really is me. The mind is me. The sense organs are me. The vrittis are me. The depression is me. The sorrow is me. Because they all totally depend upon me for their being. But they come and go and I still am. All the experience, all of these me experiences, this is me, and this is how I am right now, this is who I am right now. That one goes, that experience goes, and now this is me. Now this is me. Now this is me. But everything that you thought was me is gone. It goes and it goes and it goes. Who's always left is me. And so now I have to recognize there's some funny relationship going on here. The relationship that's going on with me and this world is very much like the relationship between me and the dream, or me and my imagination, where the imagination and all the characters in it is so real if you're a character within the imagination, but that whole imagination depends upon me,
I am its one self that is not touched by it. That's our situation here. This me that I love, that is me, is the very me that is Brahman. There's no other me. The most intimate me that I know is me. Now I learn that this me that I know is actually the me that from which the whole creation comes. The one who's free from the whole creation, the one from whom the whole creation comes. That is this me. Now, understanding that, which you're coming to understand again and again and again, okay? Understanding that, you just think about this. What is more dear to you than yourself? This me, this person that you are. What is more dear, you know? Try to think of something that is more dear. I don't think there is anything, you know. If something is dear from you, now we have to look at it like this. That which is the most dear, right? Is that going to be something positive or negative? You're such a mean, horrible person. There's nothing more dear to me than you. You love me, you make me so happy, you're the most dear to me, you make me so happy. What does that really mean? What is most dear? We'll change the language. You are the most dear to me as long as you make me so happy. That little as long as is kind of a tricky word there. Now, let's look like this. When that ananda, when I'm just with myself, when I feel myself, I feel so happy, you know. But that happiness is not something I'm looking at. Oh, I'm so happy, look at over there. You know, it's not something I'm looking at. Even if somebody makes me happy, you know, I'm saying you are the cause of my happiness, you did something to give me a shantavritti. But even the shantavritti is not something I'm looking at. I am happy. That ananda belongs to me. It only seems to come and go because of the shantavrittis coming and going, and then I'm competing with those dark vrittis. But even then, forget the shantavrittis. Are you dear to yourself or not? And is there somebody more dear to you than yourself? That's a really interesting question. I would say that the answer is no. Your child may be more dear to you because you could not tolerate the grief, the loss of your child. Knock on wood. Yeah. Your loss of your parents, your loss of your loved one. You can't tolerate the thought of their loss because you could not tolerate the unhappiness that would bring you. You know, it's not because you're not the most dear. You are the most dear. You can't tolerate the very thought of that dearness being covered by the most deep, dark dukkha-vritti. So this me, it's something to... Really, we have to do some contemplations and meditations on this, because it's really in this understanding that raga dvesha become actually irrelevant. If what is the most beloved and most dear is my being, and my raga dveshas, my likes and dislikes, when they're thwarted, right? When they're thwarted, those likes and dislikes create so much dukkha for me. And even when the raga dveshas are not thwarted, they only last for a short period of time. Just remember the garage sale. The garage sale should always just be in your mind, garage sale. To see how long, you know, these very dear, dear things, these desires last. Unfortunately, almost everything, even you can put all people in the garage sale, you know. You can put their pets. Everybody goes in the garage sale.
you know, because at some time or another, they don't contribute to your ananda vrittis. Right? That's why, you know, in India, that's very wonderful. Their marriages will let, used to, they're getting westernized now. If you get married, it's for life. Because you don't have this idea that the reason I'm married is because you are my source of ananda. That is a huge responsibility. It's not going to work. It will not work. Nobody can be, no thing can be anybody's source of ananda all of the time. You'll never ever experience it because you keep changing also. So, okay, you go like this to your partner. Oh, I love you so much. You are my source of ananda. And then as you're growing, you're changing a little bit. You're not my source of ananda. You have to make some adjustments there. Because now I want something else. You know, I want you to be a little different now. Okay. So can you please, let's just tweak the dial there. Okay. Now, that's good. Okay. Yeah. You're once again my source of ananda. And then the other person's doing that too. So there's a lot of tweaking going on. You know, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. So you get married because you love each other and you're compatible. And it's not that you put this big unfulfillable desire onto your partner. It just simply won't work. You might as well just get the divorce right now. I'm telling you all this now just to protect you. May you be happy for the rest of your life. No raga dvesha. Neutralize these raga dveshas. You know, just neutralize them. That's what we all have to do. They have to be non-binding desires because they don't deserve that other stature. There is no ananda out here. I am the ananda. There's a whole world. My whole world rotates, circles around my ananda. That's the truth of it. About the beloved nature, the most beloved nature of myself. The whole world for me rotates around this me. You know, and that's true for every being. And every being at some point becomes a mumukshu, realizing that this isn't working. It's all of this is only for me and it's not serving me. And then you realize it's not serving me because it cannot. You know? And so I keep having to, ananda seems to keep coming and going with these shanta vrittis. So it's the person, only the person that recognizes this, that can have shanti. You know, those raga dveshas, they have to become non-binding desires. They must become that because the ananda doesn't exist out there. And so if they're a binding desire, that means that I really need this to be happy. And that ananda, which is my own nature, there's nothing more dear than that. That means there's nothing more dear than that. I am that. There is nothing more dear than me. And so these desires are serious. They're serious because of self-ignorance, I'm projecting me out there. This the most beloved ananda or wholeness is projected out on these objects. And I have to have that to be happy. I have to have it to get myself back. So to have a non-binding desire means really that I have recognized through teaching as a mumukshu, as a jignyasu, somebody who wants this knowledge, I have recognized that the ananda is not the source, is not out here, that it is my very being, it is me. The ananda is me. And then I can break these binding desires that are a product of ignorance, a product of the projection of myself onto the world. That's what they are. There's nothing but ajnanam, you know. I recognize that, and then I'm able to gain some control over these fancies that are lighting up here and lighting up there. I can gain control because I have knowledge, but I'm acting like I'm ignorant. I'm acting like I'm ignorant because I have from beginningless time, been projecting lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. My ananda is out here and I have to get it. And so you don't just get this knowledge that the teacher tells you and it really makes a lot of sense. You see it
and you walk out the door and, because there's too much habitual thinking going on. Naturally. Remember, I told you, get out the door, and I was so enlightened for the moment, and I was then I. By the time I was out the door, it was all gone, and I thought, someday I'll make it to my room. That's why it takes some time. But that ability to pull back, you know, your sense pursuits, to have that freedom, that strength to pull it back, is really based upon your recognition of where the locus of ananda is. And so as you gain that knowledge, that recognition, you are able more and more to do that. And it is the person that can easily do that that is a stitta prajna. So this is exactly, so just read over this verse one more time. Let me stop. So this verse, now he's summing up everything for this chapter. So he says, Apuryamanam achala pratishtam samudram, who I am as though in this ocean that is actually steady, for such, as the waters will come in, all of these vagadveshas will come in, not causing any change in my being at all. The stitta prajna is the one who is like that. The one with all these kamas, all of these things that light up for other people, all of these raga dveshas, oh, this would be nice, this would be nice. All of the sense perceptions, say the sense organs are wandering about, having this experience, this experience, this experience. Infinite number of experiences can just come in to me. I don't care. It doesn't make any difference. It's not as though I now again have regained my ignorance to superimpose my ananda onto this sense experience, thinking that this will make me happy. I have no such illusion. So for the jnani, all of these experiences can come in. I can do this and I can do that. I can enjoy this and I can enjoy that. But they're all completely non-binding. Out of the ananda of myself, I enjoy all of these experiences. There's no one left inside. There's no ajnanam left inside that literally, actually thinks that my ananda is out there and has something to do with that sense object. That person's not even there anymore. It's not the person. That ajnanam is gone. And so that person is a stitta prajna. For that one, then I can be free to actually be here, to be here now, and to be excited about the world, to be excited about Ishvara, to get involved with everything that's going on here, because I'm free to be involved because I don't need it to be in a particular way. So the freedom is extraordinary. The ananda that I thought was out here is not. It is me. I am the one that I've always been searching for, and it is this very personal me. So such a person that recognizes that, really you're like the ocean. You're like the ocean that nothing is filling up and nothing is taking away. Say you go and take, you know, big shiploads of water out of the ocean. You just, oh my gosh, they're drying me up. Not going to happen. Or the rivers are tumbling into the ocean. Stop, stop, it's too much, you're filling me up too high. No, the ocean is just fine. It's fine. It can take any amount of loss and any amount of gain. It notices nothing. Like that, nothing happens to me. And actually, truly, this very beautiful me is a different order of reality. I'm a different order of reality than anything happening in the dream. I'm a different order of reality than anything that's happening in this creation. I remain pure and untouched. Nobody can do anything about it. So I can just be here. I have this body, mind, sense organs, my karmas take me through this world. I can just enjoy walking through Ishvara, basically, and just relaxing, let Ishvara take care of the whole thing. Take it easy. Om Purnamadah Purnamadah.
Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.